gonna sing Redeemed, Redeemed, How I Love to Proclaim It.
Read you a text exchange between myself and one of our congregants. I'll allow him to remain anonymous, but his initials are Micah Gingrich. Does that help?
Hey.
Last week, as we were finishing up, I had said a couple times during the sermon that I could see that Micah was cogitating. He was thinking hard about something. And then afterwards, he came up and asked a question, and we had a good discussion here. And I said, you know, if you were thinking that through, chances are others were too. If not in the room, at very least on the internet, other folk were having the same thought. And so, as he was leaving, I said, remind me next week, and we'll talk about it. And as he was walking out the door, he turned to me and said, remind me to remind you that you need to remember that. So last night I texted him and said, this is your reminder to remember to remind me of the thing I asked you last week to remind me of before you told me to remind you. A few minutes later, I got a text that said, hey, Jim, if you want to say something tomorrow about temptation tomorrow and how it's used in the scripture, this is your reminder. And I wrote back, oh, good, thanks for reminding me. After all that, how could I forget?
It's what you have in Costello.
Exactly. Here was what we discussed. The difficulty that Micah was working his way through is the fact that we read last week, lead us not into temptation. And I said that the word temptation there means a sore trial, a difficult trial that you go through. And then I mentioned in passing that some folk struggle with that particular petition because in James 1:13, we read, "Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am being tempted by God,' for God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone." And so Micah said, is that a different word? Because we know that the Bible doesn't contradict itself. And yet here we have Jesus saying, pray to God, lead us not into temptation. And then you have James saying, when someone is tempted, you're not being tempted by God. There seems to be an apparent conflict there. If God doesn't tempt us, why do we say to him, well, then don't lead us into temptation? And so we took a look at the Greek words, and both Jesus and James are using different forms of the same word, so it's not a question of different words. And so we looked, of course, at the context. Everybody turned to James 1. We're going to look at James 1 starting in verse 13 because James does define for us the type of temptation that he is speaking about. Jesus was talking about the kinds of difficult trials, sore trials of our soul that God very frequently puts his people through. You see it all the way through the Old Testament. As soon as you see 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, God chooses a people and then puts them through a trial. And the purpose of those trials is for the building up of our faith, to cause us to look to him, to see him as the source of our strength to get through the difficulties and the trials. It's why Paul would also say that there is no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. And then he writes, but God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that which you are able, but will with the temptation provide a way of escape so that you're able to bear it. The assumption, even behind that bit of theology, is that the trials, the difficulties, are going to come. In the prayer, Jesus also included the phrase, and deliver us from evil, poneros, the word for the evil one. And we know that when God brings about trials like he took Job through, those were trials that were actually God allowed, and yet it was Satan who did it. So Satan is God's foot soldier through whom these trials come about. Starting, I think, all the way back at the Garden of Eden, had God not wanted Satan to be in the garden, he would have kept him out. Had God not wanted Adam and Eve to have access to the tree of life, he wouldn't have put it in the garden. So he provided both the temptation and the tempter because he had already determined that his son was going to get all the glory. And he determined that in calling his son the lamb slain before the foundation of the world. And so it was always his intention that his son would get all the glory in redeeming a people. So there had to be a people who needed to be redeemed. And God in his sovereignty brought about that exact situation here on planet Earth. So God works out his sovereign will and uses both the evil of mankind and the evil of Satan to accomplish his ultimate good. All things do, in fact, work together for good to those who love God, who are the called according to his purpose. So that's why Jesus could say, lead us not through these difficult trials and deliver us from the evil one, since he is so often the method through which God brings these trials. So then what about James? Well, James tells us contextually the type of temptation he's speaking of. Let's start in verse 12. Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial. Same concept, same idea. When you go through the trials, when you go through the struggles, this is the same James who writes in verse 2, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. So he says, when the trials come, when the difficulties of life come, rather than assume that God has abandoned you, assume that he is teaching you, he is training you, he is building you into the person he has intended to make you into. So consider it joy, my brethren, when you encounter these various trials. By the way, that's a real difficult thing to do. Nobody here goes through the middle of a trial and goes, "Whee! This is fun." It wouldn't be a trial if it was enjoyable. And yet James could pull back that curtain so that you could see behind the trial and say, if indeed God is sovereign, if he is in charge, then nothing enters your life that he did not intend to have enter your life. I like the phrase, nothing can reach you that does not first pass through nail-scarred hands. Then it gets to you. So it all has purpose, and the purpose is the building up of your endurance. In verse 4, he says, so let endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. So this is all part of God building you into the person that he is intending to make you into. So endure it. Don't fall back. Don't faint. I know I keep adding layers here, but even Jesus, in talking about the various kinds of soil, when he was talking about the parable of the sower, said that there were those people who, because they had no root, as soon as the trials of this life came, or the deceitfulness of riches, they would fade away. Because a trial separates the truly redeemed from the people who were just playing with it. There are plenty of folk who will say, I'm Christian, or they join a church or whatever, for what they can get out of it. But as soon as the difficulty comes, they fall away. And so the trials, the difficulties, the struggles build character, build endurance, build strength. And so he could say in verse 12, blessed is the man who perseveres under a trial. Why are you blessed? Because you've persevered. That means that God, working in you and through you, has kept you strong despite the trial, and that was the point and the purpose of the trial. So blessed is a man who perseveres under trial, for once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I'm being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. Now he defines what he's talking about. Verse 14, but each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. So the kind of tempting that James is talking about when he says, let no man say when he's tempted, he's being tempted by God, he's talking about those kind of temptations that end up in lustful, fleshly behavior. And you know the type of stuff he's talking about. Our world is absolutely awash in fleshly, lustful behavior. And no one gets to blame God for that. I knew a man many years ago. Oh, should I tell this? But it's a good example of what I'm talking about. I knew a man who was a raging alcoholic. And when confronted about his alcoholism, he said, you're the one who keeps saying God is sovereign. If he's in charge and he wants me sober, he'll make me sober. Well, that's exactly what James is saying. You don't get to blame God for the fact that you have just given in to your fleshly lust. That's the kind of tempting that you can't blame on God. But the trials that are meant to build up your endurance, that are meant to build up your faith and construct character, to create solidity in your faith. Solidity, is that a word? If it's not, I used it in a sentence. It works, okay. That kind of trial, that kind of testing has a purpose And in fact, God is in charge of that. Now, he may use Satan to bring it about, like he did with Job, but he's still in charge of it because it has function, it has purpose. But no one gets to say, I'm like this, I'm this sinful, I'm this full of fleshly lust because this is how God made me. How often have we heard that used as an excuse in our modern culture and even pop songs? I was born this way. That becomes an excuse. Of course, when people use that excuse, well, I was born this way, I always say, yes, you were. That's the problem. You were born sinful. You were born this depraved. You need to get born again this way. That's what you need. So do you see the distinction? Do you see the difference? Jesus could say, when you go through the trials that are for the building of your faith, God is behind those things. And sometimes he uses Satan to accomplish those things. And so when you pray to him, you can pray, especially given the history of Israel and the trials that they had gone through, you can say, lead us not into temptation and deliver us from the evil one. And you can say that to your father. And James can equally say, the trials and the testing are good for building endurance, but when you're talking about your lustful fleshly activity, you don't get to blame that on God. Does that make sense? All right, very, very good. Turn to Matthew 6. After Jesus talked a bit about prayer, after he gave the model prayer, remember that the large context of this section of the Sermon on the Mount is all, don't be like the hypocrites. And so he's going to go back to yet another example of not being like the hypocrites. But that's also not his final word when it comes to prayer. He's still going to say more about the methodology of prayer. Turn forward slightly to chapter 7. Chapter 7, verse 7. Remember, I told you that the word prayer means to ask toward. And so when you go and pray to God, you're asking things of God. In verse 7 of chapter 7, he says, ask and it will be given to you, seek and you shall find, knock and it shall be opened to you, for everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and he who knocks it shall be opened. Now you may be saying to yourself, but I tried that. Yeah. I did that. Well, each of these words, ask, seek, knock, all of those words are in a particular verbal Greek tense. In the Greek language, it's a very verbal language. Sometimes in the construction of a sentence in the Greek language, they'll put the verb right up front if the action is the important thing. Very different than the way English grammar is constructed. And they have all these different tenses. There are forms of Greek verbs that are talking about an action in the past, where the results of the action are also past. There's a form of a Greek verb that has to do with actions in the past that have ongoing, continuing results. There are present participles, things that you do right now, present actions that you're involved in right now that have ongoing effects. There are some that you do now that have future effects. Well, each of these words, ask, seek, and knock, is in what's called a present tense. In other words, it's the kind of thing that you're doing presently, no matter what present you're in. I used to define it as, it's something you do now, and now, people are nodding, they remember the lesson, and now, and when tomorrow becomes your now, you're still doing it. In other words, you ask and you continue the activity of asking. The results, by the way, finding and the opening, those are all in a future tense. So you ask now, anticipating that God is going to do these things. But then Jesus takes the time to help define the types of things he's talking about that you ask for continually. Verse 9. Or what man is there among you, when his son shall ask him for a loaf of bread, will give him a stone? Or if he shall ask for a fish, he won't give him a snake, will he? Well, the answer, of course, is no. You'd have Child Protective Services on you instantly. Daddy, I'm hungry. Here's a rock and a dangerous viper. You're not going to do that. You're going to give him bread and fish, food. Now look at the next thing that Jesus says. Verse 11, and if you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more shall your Father who is in heaven give what is good to those who ask him? And there it is again in that constant present tense. So I think what he's getting at here is all the way back at the Lord's Prayer, you had to say, give us today our daily food. Well, that's a daily activity then. You have to ask every time. You have to ask and keep asking. This is not vain repetition. This is continuity of recognition that he's the one who supplies you with everything you have. And you go and you ask. But the example he gave is the same example that he used in the prayer. Give us today our daily bread, and which of you, being a father, even though you are evil, I like the fact that he recognized that human beings aren't any good to start with, nevertheless, we know how to do good things. And if we, being evil, know how to give good things to our children, how much more God, who is good, how much more will he give good things to those children who ask him? And that is our inspiration to go and ask and ask and ask. Now, when you get to James, we won't turn there right now for sake of time, but he talks about that and says, and sometimes you get jealous because people have things you don't have. He said, so then you murder. And because you're not getting what you want, you go to war and you fight with people. And then you ask and you don't receive, he says, because you ask amiss, because you're looking to heap it on your flesh. So there are limitations to the asking. If you go to God and you say, I want a new Cadillac, and I want it now, and he doesn't do it, he never promised you that. But he has promised you food and raiment every day, something to eat, something to wear every day. Is there anybody in this room that'd be willing to testify that you have eaten and been dressed your whole life? Anybody here wandered hungry and naked? Really, four people raised their hands. The rest of you are liars. Liars, liars, liars. But we know, even though we're sinful creatures, we know how to give food to our children because we know they're hungry. And we know how to put clothes on our children because we know they need clothes. And so you go back to God and you ask every day for the very same good things you know he has, that you know he's going to give you, that he knows is a loving father, he understands that you need, and that he is going to provide for you. But you go back and ask, and you ask now, and you ask now, and you ask now, and you keep going back and asking God for the good things. And he keeps providing the good things. We, because we're sinful, don't know what the good things are. And sometimes we think a good thing is I want a mansion and I want a Cadillac and I want increased wealth and I want all. I think that's good stuff. Except that that's all the stuff of the world. Now, it's fine if God gives you some of that. Everyone here has a place to live. Most of us live in a manner that would have made these first century Israelites to whom Jesus was talking, would have made every one of them jealous. If you have air conditioning, you're ahead of all these people. And most of us have air conditioning in our vehicles. We walk on carpet. They walked on dust. We have shoes. They had sandals. You understand what I'm saying? We have running water. We have indoor plumbing. We have all these wonderful, wonderful blessings that these people couldn't even begin to conceive of. And yet Jesus could say, if you ate today and you have something to wear, God faithfully provided for you again. So go back and ask and go back and ask and go back and ask. Most of us are blessed so far beyond our comprehension that it's impossible for us to go back and thank God for everything he's done because we take it so for granted. was just thinking of so many random examples. I live with my two kids who are sometimes home, sometimes not. Which means in order for me to eat a meal, really all I need is a plate, a fork, a knife. I have a cabinet full of plates. I have so many plates that I have a dishwasher to put dirty plates in. I have a drawer full of forks and knives. I don't need those. But do you know why I have them? Because it's more convenient to go get a clean fork out of the drawer than to wash the fork I just used. Because I have so much stuff. You understand what I'm saying? At a birthday a couple months ago, my kid said, "What do you want? We need to get you a birthday gift. What do you want?" And I walked through the house going, "I have everything. I don't really need anything." That's how phenomenally blessed I am. And Jesus says, go back every day and ask and ask and ask and ask and continue asking, and he will continue providing for you the good things that you need to get you through another day. And if you're asking for the purpose of heaping it on your flesh, the reason you didn't get it is because you asked amiss. You asked for the wrong reasons. Does this all make sense? Okay, good. You're nodding your heads, but the folks on the internet can't hear the rattling. And so you have to speak. We're now in chapter 6. After he has given us the model prayer, he then turns his attention back to don't be like the hypocrites. And the next large topic he's going to address is fasting. Now, fasting is a fairly controversial idea these days in the church. There are seminars and there are books and there are websites devoted to Christian fasting. But I'll tell you right up front, nowhere in the New Testament is there a prescription for fasting. Nobody says how you fast, how long you fast. There are no directives in the Bible, in the New Testament in particular, about fasting. But you have to understand that when Jesus was speaking to these Israelites in the first century, they had a long history of fasting. The Old Testament is full of fasting. Now, we all, by the way, fast on a regular basis. Every 24 hours you fast. While you're sleeping, you're not eating. That's all fasting means. To fast is to not eat. And during the time you're asleep, you're not eating, you're technically fasting, which is why the first meal you eat is your break fast, which is where the word breakfast comes from. It's even spelled that way. If you just look at it, it's two words. It's break fast. You're now eating something. But intentional fasting, denying your body of food, is something that is woven all the way through the Old Testament, as I'm going to show you in just a moment, and is an assumed practice in the New Testament. The assumption is that you will occasionally fast. The idea being that you will take some time and deny your body one of the essential things. You've just said to God, "Give me daily food." I have stressed for the last few weeks how important food was to that first century audience. You get up every day and find food. That is a primary activity of every single day. And once in a while, you would stop that fleshly craving for food and deny your body, because throughout the New Testament, every place that you see fasting, it's usually in conjunction with fasting and prayer. And so you deny your body so that you can go and pray and concentrate on God and on heavenly and spiritual things while suppressing your physical needs. In the Old Testament, let me give you some examples. They would fast during wars or at the very threat of a war. Israel fasted at Bethel in the war against the Benjamites. You can read about that in Judges 20. They fasted when loved ones were sick. David fasted and wept for his son while his boy was ill, the child of Bathsheba that ultimately died. The psalmist also mentions fasting for his enemies in Psalm 35. They fasted when they sought God's forgiveness. Moses fasted 40 days because of the sin of Israel. Ahab fasted to be forgiven in 1 Kings 21. Nineveh fasted when Jonah showed up. Remember, they fasted in sackcloth and ashes. Daniel fasted as he confessed the sins of Israel. And there was a general fast at the communal reading of the law. In Nehemiah 9, Ezra stood up and read the whole law, and as an act of penitence, because they had broken the law, all of Israel fasted. And so it was a way of showing God sincerity and genuineness in repentance. They fasted when they faced some kind of impending danger. Like, for instance, Jehoshaphat fasted when he was threatened by Edom. Ezra led a fast when seeking the favor of God toward his return from exile. Nehemiah fasted when he heard about the state of Jerusalem in Nehemiah 1:4. The Jews fasted when they heard that Haman had obtained the king's decree against them. You can read about that in Esther. Once they found out that Naaman had a decree to kill all the Jews, what did the Jews do? They fasted. It was a way of showing God that they were afflicting themselves as they cried out to him. And they set up fasts to commemorate some calamities. During and after the exile, special fasts were observed during the days that the calamities had befallen Jerusalem. On the 10th day of the 5th month was the burning of the temple that you read about in Jeremiah 52. So they proclaimed a fast. It was a way of showing repentance and remorse and crying out to God and afflicting their bodies. During the siege of Jerusalem, there was a fast. On the 9th day of the 4th month was the fall of Jerusalem, and there was a fast declared. You can read about that as we will as we continue through 1 and 2 Kings. So fasting permeates the Old Testament, and fasts were declared for all kinds of reasons, but primarily they were a way of denying yourself in order to show sincerity toward God. So naturally that idea would work its way into the New Testament, and fasting and prayer would be in conjunction as a way to restrict our own fleshly desires while we pray to him. Keep your finger where you are in Matthew 6 and turn to Isaiah 58 for a moment. And we're going to read the first half of Isaiah 58, because what Jesus has to say about fasting is actually a concept that goes all the way back to Isaiah, because the people of Israel had reached the point where they were using their fasts as a way to obligate God. It was like, hey, God, look at me fasting, therefore you ought to give me what I'm asking for. And even Isaiah records God telling the Israelites, I'm not impressed by that. You can't make me do things by your fasting. And I think this is part of the basis for the comments that we're going to see Jesus make in Matthew 6. Isaiah 58, we'll start right at the beginning. Verse 1. Cry loudly, do not hold back, raise your voice like a trumpet, and declare to my people their transgression, and to the house of Jacob their sins. Yet they seek me day by day and delight to know my ways, as a nation that has done righteousness and has not forsaken the ordinance of their God. They ask me for just decisions. They delight in the nearness of God. And this is what they say, verse 3. Why have we fasted and thou hast not seen, or thou dost not see? Why have we humbled ourselves, and thou dost not notice? Behold, on the day of your fast, you find your desire, and you drive hard all your workers. Behold, you fast for contention and strife, and to strike with the wicked fist. You do not fast like you do today, to make your voice heard on high. So in other words, what he's saying is he's correcting their behavior, and he's saying, you make this pretense, you come forward to me as if you are my people, and yet I'm going to declare your transgressions. You're keeping the religious outward show, and yet I'm going to tell you where you're wrong in the midst of all this, which is that you declare your fast, and yet even as you're fasting, You drive your workers even harder during the fast. You're not fasting in a way that is honoring to God. You are fasting in a way that is all about you. You're drawing attention to yourself, even to the degree that you would say, we fasted and you don't seem to see it. We humbled ourselves and you don't seem to notice. So they started the fast with the expectation that they were going to obligate God to react to them, which would cause God, of course, to see right through that ruse and point out to them that that doesn't work. Because verse 4, you fast for contention and strife and to strike with a wicked fist. You don't fast like you do today. They had finally come to him in penitence. Verse 5, is it a fast like this, which I choose a day for a man to humble himself? Is it for bowing one's head like a reed and for spreading out sackcloth and ashes as a bed? Will you call this fast, even an acceptable day to the Lord? In other words, won't you make that the kind of fasting you're doing? Notice the description. It's for the humbling of yourself, for the bowing of your head, for spreading out sackcloth and ashes as a bed to lay on. This kind of fast that is full of humility is the kind of fast that God approves of. Is this not the fast which I choose, says verse 6? This kind of fast, look at the description, to loosen the bonds of wickedness, to undo the bands of the yoke, and to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke. In other words, if you're cruel people to begin with, and then you fast, God's not impressed. Instead, he says, your fasting needs to be part and parcel of your larger life, an example that you are, in fact, humbling yourself before God, and part of that humility would show itself in how you treat other people. So you cannot mistreat, in this case, your servants, the people who belong to you, your workers. You can't be mistreating them and then going in front of God and saying, look at me fast, aren't I humble? Because God can see from your behavior that in fact there's no humility in you. You're still arrogant. You're fasting despite the fact that you're still looking for a fight. Verse 7. Is it not to divide your bread with the hungry? That's what a proper fast would be. You deny yourself so that others could have something. And bring the homeless, poor, into the house. When you see the naked, you cover them. And not to hide yourself from your own flesh. In other words, your own kindred, the people who also have a need. Notice, by the way, the particular needs that he pointed out. He pointed out bread, which is food, and clothing, if they're naked, cover them. Food and raiment, keep showing up. And if there are poor homeless outside, you bring them into the house. Then your light, verse 8, if that's the way you behave, then your light will break out like the dawn, and your recovery will speedily bring forth. And your righteousness will go before you. The glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. In other words, the glory of God goes ahead of you and he protects you from behind. Don't you really want that? Don't you want God to completely surround you, go in front of you and guard you from the back? That's what you want, of course. Then you will call and the Lord will answer. You will cry and he will say, here I am. If you remove the yoke from your midst, the pointing of the finger and the speaking of wickedness. Notice that. It's not just take that yoke, that burden that you put on other people. It's stop pointing your finger at other people and stop speaking wickedness. And if you give yourself to the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then your light will rise in darkness and your gloom will become like midday. And the Lord will continually guide you and satisfy your desire in scorched places and give strength to your bones, and you will be like a watered garden and like a spring of water whose waters do not fail. And those from among you will rebuild the ancient ruins, and you will raise up the age-old foundations, and you will be called the repairer of the breach and the restorer of the streets in which you dwell. So there will be an outbreak of goodness and godliness among you, Israelites, if you will fast properly. You get all that? Matthew 6. As hard as it is to believe, technically, that was all introduction. That is hard to believe, isn't it? Micah shook his head. He went, no, that's not hard to believe. I believe that completely. Matthew 6, starting at verse 16. With all that background, now I think we can understand Jesus saying, and whenever you fast, notice the assumption is that you will. These are the Israelites. They have regular fasts. They have scheduled fasts. They have calendrical days of fasting. And whenever you fast, do not put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do, for they neglect their appearance in order to be seen as fasting by men. There's that same theme we've seen over and over again. When you do your alms, don't do it to be seen of men. When you pray, don't do it to be seen of men. When you're fasting, don't do it to be seen of men. Now picture this for a moment, because he's talking about the hypocrites, he's talking about the Pharisees, who are the ones who would blow a trumpet when they would do their alms so people would notice. They would make long, big prayers on the street corner or in the middle of the temple so that people would see them praying and say, oh, how holy these people are. But then when they would fast, they weren't satisfied that God would see their fast. They wanted other people to notice they were fasting. So they would make themselves look hungry. And they would make themselves look weak. So people would go, you okay? What's wrong? Oh, I'm fasting. Just humble little me. Just doing some stuff for God. They neglect their appearance in order to be seen as fasting by men. And once again, Jesus says the same thing that he said over and over. They already got their reward. They get nothing from God. The purpose of fasting is a form of penitence or a form of sincerity or a form of prayer and neglecting the body toward God. Ultimately, it is a worship toward God. It is a declaration that God is sufficient and that he is provider, and that you see him as superior to every other facet of your life, that even if you had to do without food, if you had to do without shelter, if you had to do without clothing, even if you were reduced to sackcloth and ashes, he would still be God and you would still praise him anyway. Amen. Nevertheless, these people wanted other people to see them and go, wow, look at them fast. They are really holy. And he said, you know what? They got nothing from God for that. It's supposed to be about God. It's supposed to be done for God's glory, and they get nothing from God because humans saw them do it. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, notice the next phrase, when you fast, the assumption is that you will. But you, when you fast, anoint your head, wash your face, so that you may not be seen as fasting by men, but by your Father, who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will repay you. So if you are fasting, and I say again, there is no formula in the New Testament anywhere. There is no prescription for fasting. There's nothing that says when you fast, it needs to be 48 hours or a week. Or there's no, if you're fasting for prayer, it's this long. If you're fasting for a need, it's this long. If you're fasting over the loss of a loved one, so there's nothing like that. Instead, there is simply the assumption that because you are the people of God, because you belong to him, because you have his spirit inside you, that you will deny yourself and that you will humble yourself before God. Now, if you fast for one day, you wake up and you don't eat anything until the sun goes down, that's a legitimate fast. If you decide you're going to fast for 3 days and you make a vow to God, I'm not going to eat for 3 days because I'm going to pray to you and I want to deny my body, and you do that, that's a legitimate fast. I have a preacher friend who says once a month I fast. I go 24 hours without food once a month. And he said, I started out doing it for God's glory and as a means of prayer and just a way to systematically once a month force myself to deny my bodily desires, just as a discipline. He said, and the funny part is I got healthier. I lost weight. I'm doing better. He said, so there were actually benefits to fasting beyond what he even saw from the Bible. He said, I guess God who made us knows what he's talking about. It turns out it's actually good for us to also fast. The assumption is, though, that you will, as God's people, occasionally take the time to make him your primary interest. And you won't give in to your physical needs, and you will deny your flesh. And by the way, eating is a big flesh denial. Who was it earlier? Devante, when he was standing up here reading, did you not use the phrase, even when I starved? I thought I heard the word starved in there somewhere, but that's okay. Because we all use that word so frequently, so often. Are you hungry? I'm starving. No, you're not. There are people on the planet who are starving. You're not one of them. But we don't deny ourselves anything where food is concerned. I think it's funny how often we will say, well, I need to eat right. I need to eat healthy. I need to eat better. I need it. But football's on. So that's a good excuse to not eat well. I don't get that. It's just, you know, see? The football folk are right. I wouldn't normally eat those, but football's on. And or any other event. No, I don't eat sweets. I don't. It's your birthday? Cake? I'm in. And so, because we don't deny ourselves when it comes to food. We go to a restaurant and sit down, and there's several pages in the menu of available foods we can have. And the waitress will come by and say, you ready to order? No, I don't know what I'm going to have. There's so many good choices. I want a little of everything. We don't deny ourselves food. So can you see why God would point at that? The provision that you need every day. Give me today my daily food. And he would choose that as the thing that if you want to worship, praise him, if you want to show his value in your life, deny yourself that fundamental need, that fleshly need for food. All the way back at the Garden of Eden, the way that Satan tempted Eve was threefold. He showed her that the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was pleasant to the eye, that it was desirable to make one wise, and that it was good for food. This is edible. I'm always amazed at the things people eat, especially when you see some of the really peculiar things coming out of like the Orient, and they're eating bizarre things, and I often think, who was the first person who decided that was good for food? That's not something you should put in your mouth. Don't eat that. Because people will eat anything. Can I fry it? Can I cook it? Can I bake it? I'll eat it. This is tree bark. Oh, well, I could probably eat that. Because we'll eat anything. The desire for food is so difficult to satiate. And by the way, you can eat so much that you're absolutely stuffed and say, boy, I won't eat again. 3 hours later, you'll be like, I'm hungry. Let's eat more. Can you see why God would hone in on that desire and say, deny that? Because it is a fundamental craving that is built into our fleshly bodies. And so it's a good way to show God, I'm going to prioritize you. I'm going to spend the next 24 hours in prayer and reading your word, and I'm going to deny my flesh. This is a good form of worship. But when you do that between you and God who sees in secret, will take care of rewarding you. Don't be like the hypocrites. Don't make a big show of it. Don't walk around going, oh, poor me. I'm fasting. You get it? Now, what I want to do to close up this section is that I want you all to do the interpreting. This will be fun. Because Jesus says a couple things here that are just really obvious on their face. And yet really tough for us to internalize and really believe. So you're going to do the interpreting. Verse 19. Do not lay up for yourselves treasure upon earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasure in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. What's he saying? Don't rely on earthly possessions. What else?
Don't leave an inheritance to yourself.
Pardon me?
Don't leave an inheritance to yourself.
Don't leave an inheritance to yourself. When you die, how much do you take with you?
None.
None. Yeah. Everything you accumulate, you leave behind. Bill Gates, when he dies, how much of his wealth does he leave behind? All of it. Every single bit of it. Remember Jesus saying, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? If you have to stand before God, who is not a respecter of persons, and you have to give an answer for every idle word, will it matter whether or not you were a billionaire? Mm-mm. No. What does it mean, lay up treasure in heaven? What does that mean?
I said, seek ye first the kingdom of God.
Seek ye first the kingdom of God?
That should be your goal.
That should be your goal. What does it also mean, don't lay up treasures on earth, but lay up treasures in heaven? He created a contrast there. What does that mean?
Spend your money for the poor, homeless, those in need.
Use the money that he has given you. Use the food that he has given you. Remember we just read out of Isaiah. Use the stuff, the house, the things that he has given you for the benefit of other folk. He has already defined it in the three things that he talked about the hypocrites doing in his comparisons when he said, don't be like the hypocrites. They make a big deal of their alms. You give your alms in secret, so secret that you don't let one hand know what the other hand is doing. And when you do that, your Father in heaven will repay you. That's laying up treasures in heaven. When you pray, don't be like the hypocrites who make a big show or use repetitive words because they think they're going to be heard for their much speaking. Instead, you go into the innermost room of your house and you shut the door and you pray to your Father in secret, and your Father who hears in secret will repay you. It's laying up treasure in heaven, not on earth. You don't have people on the planet going, look at you go, look at how you fast. You have been fasting for days, and I can tell because of how gaunt you look, and I can tell that you're just so weak. Oh, you are really fasting. No, when you fast, you anoint your head, you wash your face, and you don't look like you're fasting, and your Father who sees in secret will repay you. That's all laying up treasure in heaven. You can live your whole life trying to get the world to recognize and appreciate you. You can spend your whole life trying to get the world to glorify you and say how wonderful you are. And unfortunately, that kind of thinking has also permeated too much of modern Christendom to the point where people stand up in the church and want to be recognized and appreciated or put on a show or sell their newest album or their DVDs or their products. I've got new t-shirts. I've got, look at me, dig me, more, me. Or you can live out your Christianity in such a way that when you do your good works, when you pray, when you fast, you live out those very godly behaviors in such a way that only God knows. And even if nobody else knows, God knows. And that is satisfying for you because you know that when you get there, like James said, there will be laid up for you that crown of righteousness. And I'll tell you what, I would much rather have God say good job than some person say good job.
I'd like to confess I've spent money in the last few years on people who really didn't need it when I should have been spending it on people who needed it.
Yeah. Fortunately, we believe in grace, so no one here is going to condemn you. So it's okay. But I understand what you're saying. Every one of us has regrets. Anybody here no regrets? Really, you raised your hand on no regrets. Really? Every word counts. You have to pay attention to the no regrets part. See?
I missed the no.
I've known a lot of people in my life. I've known a lot of people in my life. A lot of people in my life. They seem to pass through for a season. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Can you think of somebody that you knew, that you were pretty close to, that you liked, that isn't in your life anymore? That's how human relationships work. For a while, you're together, you know each other. You ever left a job And then you go around, you say goodbye to everybody, and you say, let's keep in touch. Keep in touch. Let's get together. We're going to... You don't. You never do. You never keep in touch. We've had folks leave here, and they say, we'll be in touch, because love you, mean it, I'll be in touch. They don't. They're not going to, because that's the way it happens. Now, these people, these transient people, these people who come and go through the course of your life, if I spend all my time working really hard to impress somebody who might be part of my life for 2-3 years, what have I accomplished when they leave and forget about me and I forget about them? Have I really accomplished anything? Doesn't matter how impressed they were with me. It's a poor investment. It is a poor investment with a lousy return. Okay, but what if there was something you could do that would make the God who made heaven and earth, the eternal and the sovereign one, what if there was something you could do that would be a point of remembrance that he would hold on to for all of eternity? As a remembrance. Isn't that remarkable? Yes. That God would remember the gifts that Cornelius had brought because he was a Gentile who nevertheless brought gifts to the temple, and God remembered that. Now, isn't that much more valuable than getting a coworker to be impressed because you're fasting? Make sure that the things that you do that are works of righteousness are done for God's glory, not for yours. That's what it comes down to. And if you're impressing other people, people are inconsistent. But God is consistent, and God remembers, and God is willing not only to give you eternal life, but that phrase, that confounding phrase, that difficult for me to grasp phrase, a crown of righteousness. I can't even fathom such a thing, that God would put righteousness on me. Say, now you have my son's righteousness on you, and you're going to have a victor's crown because you persevered to the end, even though it was his spirit that caused me to persevere to the end. Knowing that, I would much rather do the things that please him than the things that impress people, especially when it comes to these acts, these works of righteousness. So lay up for yourselves treasure in heaven. The contrast is between the hypocrites who are laying up their treasure on earth and those who are laying up treasure in heaven by making sure that the things they do, the righteous works, are seen by God and for God's glory. In that way, you lay up treasure in heaven. And by the way, wherever your treasure is, that's where your heart will also be. If your treasure is here on earth, if what you're storing up is all earthly good, where's your heart? Right here on earth. People who have the most to lose are the people who have the hardest time letting go. They get to the end of their life and it's time to go, and they fight and scream and claw, and the last thing they want to do is leave because they know that everything they've got is right here. And they are tied to this ground. And now they have to go stand before heavenly splendor and be judged by God. And their entire treasure is here in the dirt. And they've got nothing they can go before God with. By the way, do you remember when Al Gore was running for president? Boy, is this random. He misquoted that verse. And he was telling people to give money to his cause because he said, where your heart is, that's where your treasure should be. Remember that? A few people nodded, yeah. I remember being in my house, jumping up and going, stop it! Stop it! If you're going to pull the Bible into it as if God is on your side, at least quote it correctly. No, it doesn't say where your heart is, that's where you put your treasure. It says where your treasure is, that's where your heart's going to be. If you're laying up treasure in heaven, then your heart is in heaven. Your interest is in heaven. Your anticipation is in heaven. You can be like Paul, who could say, better to depart and be with the Lord. You're just ready to go. There was a Puritan writer years ago who, his name escapes me at the moment because things escape my brain these days. He was dying, and they sent for his daughter, who had to come from a distance. When she arrived there, he was motionless. And she said, is he gone? Or is he still living? And he replied, I am still here among the dying. Soon I shall be among the living. Isn't that a great line? His heart was all in heavenly places. He couldn't wait to leave this dying world and go be among the living. His heart was firmly planted in heavenly things. Because where your treasure is, that's where your heart's going to be also. Next week, we will start at the lamp of the body is your eye. And he's going to talk about being careful about what you look at. But we'll get into that and talk about that next week as Jesus continues to give us very good instruction about how to be his disciple, the way we ought to live and the way that we ought to conduct ourselves. All right? Questions? Yes, sir.
Kind of a comment, I guess. The more we internalize that belief, that doctrine that Jesus is teaching, the more at odds you will be with the world and the more you will feel that opposition. I mean, if I walk into Sam's now, it's almost like you can hear the merchandise, buy me, buy me, buy me, buy me. Like everything is shouting, covet, you need this, you need this, you need a new this, you need a new that, you need this, you need that. That's no longer good. I mean, it's just built into our whole society. Our whole society is based on always buying, always purchasing, storing up more and more stuff. And that way of Jesus is so radically opposed to the world in which we live. I mean, we're not like Christians in Africa. They don't really struggle with it to the same degree that we do, I believe.
Right.
I mean, they still have to store up treasures in heaven and they still have to come out of their culture, but they don't have all the stuff. We have those greater temptations than I think people have in the history of the world.
I agree. Have you ever watched the show Storage Wars?
Yeah,
I've seen it a few times, and it's sort of fascinating that people have so much stuff that they have storage lockers full of stuff that they then either forgot about or stopped paying for. And it's junk, but then other people come and bid on the junk. That's what you're saying. We want, we crave things. And it's a nonstop desire. I think it's why our society operates the way it does, is because it appeals to who we are. Consumers. Yes, sir?
If you have the money to buy a Porsche Targa, which is about $210,000, and you decide instead to give it quietly to the food bank, which of those two things will give you the greater pleasure?
Well, there is no doubt that there is a tremendous joy in giving. It was just that you put the Porsche in the middle of it, which kind of got everybody's brain moving, because Michael is right. But yes, there is a tremendous joy in giving. And the greater the gift, the greater the joy. See, the difference between you and me is, if I gave a $200,000 car, I wouldn't have talked about it. I'm so sorry. I had to do that.
Our perceptions have to be modified to see it that way.
Our perceptions have to be modified to see it that way. Absolutely.
I've spent my whole life trying to acquire and build storages here on Earth.
Yeah.
My perception was never the way it is now, or adjusting to that.
Yep. I agree. It takes a complete radical change of mind and heart. But isn't that what being born again is about? Mm-hmm. That you need to be changed? You need to be born a second time? You need to be recreated from the inside? And when it happens, it's a miraculous thing. Who could have believed you'd wind up here? Yeah. I had a philosophy professor who used to say there's no such thing as genuine altruism. And what he meant by that was even when human beings do good things, they're so conscious that they did a good thing that they're incapable of doing it altruistically just for the sake of doing the good thing. we crave somebody to recognize we did it. We need the pat on the back. We need somebody to say, oh, I saw you did. That was a good thing you did. It's really hard for us to do something genuinely good and be the only one who knows it. Because we just want somebody somewhere, please recognize that. It's really hard to be genuinely altruistic, which I think is what Michael was getting at. And it's what Wolfgang's getting at. It's a radical change from within, and it's certainly not human nature. Very, very good comments.
I hope God saw that.
I hope God saw that. Isn't that an interesting aspect of it?
I think I did it for nothing.
Yeah, exactly. I sure hope God saw that. The good news is, I can assure you, he did. But in order for him to have seen that, he saw the rest of it too. Uh-oh.
So, can
yes.
you give a brief, commentary on your view of the homeless? And, you know, there's such a scam going on. And they have cell phones, but yet, how do we deal with that?
Really, really good question. I can't individually solve all the world's problems. Even Jesus, in dealing with Judas, arguing with him and saying, why has this ointment been wasted? He said, it should have been sold and the money given to the poor. And Jesus said, the poor you'll have with you always, me you won't always have. And so the priority becomes Jesus. I can't solve every problem. I can't feed all the poor people. So I assume that God, in his good sovereignty, knows what he's doing. And when he brings somebody across my path that I can help, my job is to help them.
Show them love.
Show them love, feed them, do whatever I got to do for them, so that in taking care of that micro part of it, I can't do the macro. I can't feed everybody. We get a lot of requests because we're a public church. We get a lot of requests for money. You know, it's widely known that we're supporting the Indian orphans. And so I get requests every week from yet another orphanage, from yet another group, yet another hungry group, that we need money. And I go through rigorous processes to try to figure out if they're legitimate, because there's so much scamming going on out there, scamming of churches. So Jesus said, be wise as serpents and be gentle as doves. I try to be wise, I try to be smart, and I assume that if he brings somebody across my path that needs help, he did that on purpose. Right? After all, if King David could say that it was God who brought about the man who cursed him, you know, he saw everything to be in God's sovereign hand. So everybody who crosses my path, every friend, every enemy, I know they're there for a purpose. And if the purpose is for me to grow in learning to help them, then I'll help them. But I recognize that only God can handle the whole world. Does that make sense? So do what's in front of you right now. What's the phrase I've used forever? Do the next right thing. Tomorrow will take care of itself. You'll have right things to do tomorrow. But right now, do the next right thing.
Thank you for listening to this Sunday morning message from Grace Christian Assembly. Please visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And join us next time as we gather around the Word and study God's sovereign grace.